Explicit content is found in this episode. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to the True Crime Fan Club Podcast. I'm your host, Lainey. It's something all parents fear, that their teenagers are going to throw a massive party the first time they're trusted to stay at the house all on their own. The parents come home to a trashed house, ruined floors, or walls. Their trust in their teenagers completely gone. It can really be heartbreaking. But what about the devastation left behind if the teen decides the party is more important than the parents' lives? Okay, on to the show. In 2011, the Hadleys lived at 371 Northeast Grander Avenue in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Blake and Mary Jo had been married for 25 years and had two sons, Ryan and Tyler. Ryan, 23, was 6 years older than Tyler, 17. Ryan had moved to North Carolina in the early summer months of 2011, leaving Tyler at home with their parents. Blake and Mary Jo had moved to Port St. Lucie from Fort Lauderdale 24 years before, where they had immediately joined the St. Lucie Catholic Church. They remained active and prominent members of the church until their deaths. Reverend Mark Sarye, pastor at St. Lucie Catholic Church, where Blake and Mary Jo attended, said the couple was quiet and unassuming. Mary Jo was an elementary school teacher with the St. Lucie County School District. The last 6 years, she had been educating at the Village Green Environmental Study School. She had apparently had weight loss surgery at one time, based on comments online, which stated that her decision to have the surgery helped inform someone else to have the surgery. Parents of Mary Jo's students said that she had a lot of patience and met her students at their level. She encouraged them to find something to care about to focus their studies on. Mary Jo was described by colleagues as being an excellent voice for her fellow teachers to administrators. Her brother-in-law, Mike Hadley, described her as a kind, caring, beautiful school teacher beloved by her children and her kids in school. Blake Hadley worked for 30 years as a plant operator for Florida Power and Light. Brian Nichols, a co-worker of Blake's for 15 or 20 years, described Blake as quiet and gentle without a mean bone in his body. Nichols said he had the largest hands he had ever seen. When Blake Hadley had visited cousins in Indiana in the late 60s or early 70s, he had never seen snow. He made snowballs, and his dad brought ice so he could take the snowballs home and throw them at his friends. Tyler was known to have issues beginning at age 10. Mary Jo had taken Tyler to Dr. Willard, their pediatrician since infancy, for symptoms of depression and anxiety. Dr. Willard stated that Tyler had been born premature, weighing 3 pounds 10 ounces, resulting in an incubator stay for a month. During the visit at age 10, Dr. Willard prescribed Prozac and later prescribed Zoloft. Dr. Willard said that Tyler's parents never reported any violent or suicidal tendencies while on the medications. Mary Jo herself suffered from depression and was concerned that Tyler was following suit, so she always remained mindful of his symptoms and behavior. She had him take human growth hormones in middle school to help with his self-esteem because of his small size. Tyler also suffered from bulimia during his teen years. Other family members said of Tyler that he was very loving but often withdrawn and that he was a loner. They stated that he quit projects after starting them because he did not feel he was good enough. Tyler had allegedly dropped out of St. Lucie Centennial High School, but had taken some classes at Indian River State College. Also, he had reportedly been involved in a vehicular accident in June 2010, where he had struck and injured a child who had been walking down the street. He was driving a vehicle registered to his father. The family of that child was suing the Hadleys for $15,000. After incidents with marijuana, Tyler's family had him evaluated by Dr. Ney Andujar, a Port St. Lucie psychiatrist. Tyler was placed in a medium-level mental health program for a month in the summer of 2011. This program used group, individual, and family therapy, as well as antidepressants for treatment. He was prescribed the drug Celexa. His last session was July 15, 2011. During this last session, Tyler expressed no signs of suicidal or homicidal thoughts to Andujar. According to Andujar, Tyler had reported sleeping better and reported feeling less anxious. However, a group therapist from that day said that Hadley was frustrated and angry on July 15, 2011, due to a fight he had with his parents. There had been a false positive for methamphetamines on a home drug screening, and his father had accused him of using the drugs. On the night of July 15th, the Hadley family had dinner at a steakhouse with extended members of the family for a birthday celebration. Present at the dinner were his maternal grandparents, his uncle Sam DiVittorio Jr., and cousin Kelly Reynolds. Kelly said that everything seemed normal. His grandmother, Maggie DiVittorio, later recalled that on the way home, Tyler complained of a headache, but when his grandmother tried to rub his head, he told her, "No, that hurts." Mary Jo put her hand over his head and said they would get him some aspirin when they got home. As his grandmother was getting out, he hugged her and said, "I love you, Grandma." That would be the last time she would see Mary Jo and Blake alive. At 9:40 a.m., on the morning of July 16, 2011, in Facebook messages with a friend named Matt, Tyler is asked, "Did you do it?" And Hadley replies, "No, but I'm gonna." Matt says, "Bet. You really should now. Do it." Tyler replied, "Don't worry, I am. Then I'm having a party." At 1:15 p.m., July 16th, Tyler posted on Facebook, "Party at my crib tonight. Maybe." At approximately 5 p.m. on July 16th, Tyler Hadley brutally murdered both of his parents. At 8:15 p.m., July 16th, Hadley posted on Facebook, "Party at my house. Hit me up." At 9 o'clock p.m., the party begins. While the bodies of Blake and Mary Jo Hadley lie in their locked bedroom, approximately 60 teens and young adults show up to the party, many who do not know Tyler Hadley. Tyler told many people at the party that his parents were out of town in many different locations. He told some they were in Georgia, Orlando, or Palm Springs. He also told many people that he would be going away for a long time, and some he specifically said to prison. On July 2nd, weeks before the party, he had told one friend that he wanted to kill his mom, and the friend said that he would go to prison. During the party, where Hadley had been acting mostly normal, he pulled aside his best friend, Michael Mandel, and said he needed to tell him something. The two went into the garage where Hadley confessed to Michael that he had killed his parents that afternoon. Michael at first did not believe Tyler, so Tyler pointed to a bloody footprint on the floor. He explained that first, he'd taken his parents' cell phones away so they couldn't call for help. He then put on boots, gloves, and a jacket before he began the attacks. Tyler then told Michael he stood behind his mother, Mary Jo, for 5 minutes while she sat at the computer. In his hand, he was holding a framing hammer and finally swung it and struck her in the head. She screamed, "Why?" then screamed, "Ow, ow." He continued to strike her until she fell on the floor. Hearing her screams, his father, Blake, entered the room. Tyler and Blake locked eyes before Tyler began chasing his father, beating him to death with a hammer. Tyler said that his dad did not try to fight back and just said, "Tyler, don't do this." Michael told Tyler he wanted to see the bodies, but Tyler put him off and said wait until after the party. Michael wasn't satisfied, so he went inside to see for himself. He saw what looked to be blood in various parts of the house, on baseboards, the computer keyboard, and on door frames. He went to Blake and Mary Jo's bedroom and had to push the door open with some force. There, he saw a grisly sight: Blake's leg under a pile of trash. He quickly closed the door and made the decision to act normal, even posing for a selfie with Tyler. Michael has justified this, saying he knew it was the last time the two would ever be together and that neither one of them were happy in the photo. Tyler also revealed to Michael his plans on committing suicide when the party ended by taking 10 Percocet pills. With this knowledge, Michael ends up finding the pills and hides them from Tyler. At 2:30 a.m., some people at the party began receiving notification of another party across town, so they began leaving, noisily. One of the neighbors, Rianne Wallace, called in a noise complaint to the police. When they arrived at the home, Tyler turned out all the lights and made all the partygoers hide in his room. Since it appears the party had ended or was winding down, the police did not stay long. Tyler was upset, though, that the party had ended so soon. The party across town ended up being a false alarm. The girl who was allegedly hosting it was actually in bed. At 4:24 a.m., Michael Mandel calls Crime Stoppers in Orlando anonymously to report the murders. At 4:40 a.m., Tyler posts again on Facebook, "Party at my house again. Hit me up." 2 minutes later, police show up at his house with a concern about the adult Hadleys based on the Crime Stoppers phone call. When Tyler answered the door to police, he was frantic and very talkative and dressed all in black. Police noted that he had a blank stare with very large pupils. He explained to officers that his parents were in West Palm Beach and then declined to let them in. Officers made entry anyway, out of concern for the parents. The home was in disarray with trash, mostly alcohol bottles, scattered everywhere. One bedroom had 18 empty beer bottles on the bed. At the third bedroom door the officers came to, the door was locked from the inside. Tyler told officers it was his parents' room and he did not have a key. An officer noted what appeared to be blood on the doorframe, baseboards, and a piece of furniture, so they forced the doorknob so that the door opened. The first thing they noticed when they looked inside was blood and bloodstains on the floor and sheets. In the room, they noticed dining room chairs, a coffee table, picture frames, clothing, and towels in a pile. Under that pile, they found the bodies, face down, with towels wrapped around their heads. Between the bodies of his parents was a 22-inch framing claw hammer with a waffle pattern on the head. This waffle pattern matched marks found on the victims' backs. At 7:57 a.m., July 17, 2011, Tyler Hadley is interviewed by police at the Port St. Lucie Police Department. At 6:45 p.m., police began executing search warrants for the Hadleys' home. They also execute warrants to swab Tyler for DNA and take pictures of him for cuts and scratches. At 10:30 p.m. that night, Tyler is arrested on two counts of second-degree murder, the most serious charge they can pursue without convening a grand jury. At this time, Tyler is moved from the St. Lucie County Juvenile Assessment Center to the St. Lucie County Jail. The judge denied bail for Tyler. I'm going to pause the case right here so you can hear a word from our sponsor. The murder of two beloved citizens by their own child shocked the residents of Port St. Lucie. Adding to the shock was another murder the next day in Pembroke Pines, 100 miles away. This one was also committed by a son, killing his adoptive mother. Gerald Belmont, then 21, was arrested for brutally beating to death his adoptive mother, Natalie, who was 43. This scared the population into thinking it was an epidemic of parricide, the crime of killing your parents. Traditionally, psychiatrists say parricides are committed by single males who live at home, who probably have undiagnosed psychiatric disorders. These murders are usually excessively violent, with a sharp or blunt object as a weapon. William Weitz, a Boca Raton forensic psychologist who had experience in childhood crime, said the murder of the Hadleys were classic parricides, saying, quote, "These were very brutal, hands-on, and personal." Parricide, despite what the media depicts, is rare and academic studies are scant. However, Dr. Sarah West and Dr. Mendel Feldscher published a study in 2010 in Current Psychiatry. They concluded that mental illness is present in many cases and 86% of parricide cases are committed by males. The killings are almost always committed at home, often in bedrooms. Tyler Hadley had murdered his parents, then moved their bodies into their bedroom. The residents of Port St. Lucie took the murders of the Hadleys to heart, and many used it as a teaching tool for their children. Robin Goldberg, who at the time had daughters aged 8 and 11, decided to let her daughters watch news segments about the murders as a lesson in drug use. She told her daughters, quote, "See, don't do drugs, they change somebody. Tom Hayes, another resident of Port St. Lucie, whose sons were teenagers in 2011, discussed the Hadleys' murders over dinner. His son Sean, at the time 18, knew about the party at the Hadleys, but had no way to get there. It was one of three parties he was invited to that night. The young people of Port St. Lucie have often complained there is nothing to do in the city of 150,000. They use parties, weed, alcohol, and prescription drugs to pass the time, and often call their hometown Pot St. Lucie or Port St. Lousy. However, these types of complaints had no bearing on the Hadley murders. Tyler Hadley did not kill his parents out of boredom. In the days following the murders, Jason Mirky, a neighbor of the Hadleys, told reporters that Tyler Hadley's eyes were blank and expressionless. He said that Tyler was sneaky and emotionless. Another neighbor, Rianne Wallace, the one who had called the noise complaint in, said Tyler on TV looked nothing like the kid who grew up next door, playing basketball or football with his dad, laughing as they had to move out of the street to let her drive by. These and many other neighbors and friends were left reeling in the days and weeks after the attacks to make sense of what happened. But justice knows no such leisure. In August 2011, Judge James McCann restricted media and public access of files for the Hadley case so that widespread media coverage would not damage Tyler's ability to receive a fair trial. Mark Harley, public defender assigned to the case, noted that within 24 hours after the 911 call was released by the state attorney's office, thousands of media outlets around the world and every single newspaper in Florida were running the call. In September 2011, a grand jury was convened to review the evidence to see if the charges could be upgraded from second-degree murder to first-degree. A grand jury's primary role is to determine whether sufficient evidence exists to justify indicting an accused individual. By issuing an indictment, the grand jury in effect says there is probable cause a crime has been committed and that the person accused committed the crime. A grand jury must consist of between 15 and 21 persons. At least 12 grand jurors must agree to indict an individual. Grand jurors usually perform 5 to 6 months of intermittent service. Historically, grand juries hear evidence, deliberate, and vote in secret. During the September 14, 2011 grand jury, an autopsy report was submitted by Dr. Roger E. Middleman, chief medical examiner for the 19th Judicial Circuit. In his report, he stated that Blake Hadley received 65 blunt trauma injuries, soft tissue bruising, and massive skull fractures. Blake suffered a broken humerus, or an upper arm bone, left radius, thicker of the two lower arm bones, and left tibia, the thicker of the lower leg bones. Mary Jo suffered at least 35 blunt trauma injuries. The grand jury listened to evidence for 4 hours, but reached a decision in 15 minutes. They did agree to upgrade the charges from second-degree murder to first-degree murder. While in the St. Lucie County Jail awaiting trial, all letters to and from Tyler were copied and given to the state attorney's office as possible evidence in the case. Once they were given to the public defender's office, they became public record. On October 4, 2011, Tyler received a note from Mike and Cindy Hadley, an uncle and aunt on his father's side of the family. There was a picture of his mother included. The note read, "It is October 4, 2011. Do you know what today would have been? Your mom's 48th birthday. It is a very sad day for us. We will never be able to wish her a happy birthday again. If you're going through hell, keep going." On October 11, 2011, Tyler wrote a letter to his maternal grandparents which read, "I ruined a lot of people's lives and I can't seem to forgive myself. I find myself crying a lot too, because of the guilt. Every day I beg for forgiveness and ask God not to send me to hell. I just can't get rid of all of this guilt." He also wrote, "I wish I never started taking all that damn pill and none of this would have ever happened." It is believed that that damn pill that Tyler refers to in his letter is Celexa, which he had been prescribed in the summer of 2011. Although others believe that it was the recreational drugs he took that caused him to murder his family. Meanwhile, as he wrote of guilt to his maternal grandparents and dealt with the anger his father's side of the family had towards him, he was also signing autographs in jail. Tyler had given his fellow inmate, Justin Tony, an autograph signed, "I don't know if you're a fan, but you should be. It's Hammer Time." Tyler then signed his name. Hammer Time was a reference to the MC Hammer song You Can't Touch This from the 1990s. Tyler had several nicknames in jail, including Hambo, Hammer, and Bam Bam. Tyler continued to write letters to friends and family members, telling them he prayed he would get a good plea bargain from the state attorney. He wrote Michael Mandel that he had found God and wanted to be a priest when he got out of jail. He also told Michael that he would put him on the jail visitor list when he turned 18. The two would turn 18 just within days of each other. Michael Mandel on December 7th and Tyler Hadley on December 16th. On November 7th, 2011, police investigating a possible burglary witnessed three adolescent males go behind the Mandel home. When Michael Mandel would not open the back door, the police forced their way in. Two of the three boys surrendered, but the third ran. Officers pursued this teen, and when he was caught, a struggle ensued. Police said Michael Mandel began to fight and shout obscenities, so they charged him with resisting arrest. Michael Mandel said he was hit several times by the officers and then thrown onto a bed so forcefully he cut open his chin in the process. He requested medical attention and was denied. Michael Mandel said he was targeted and assaulted because he had avoided talking to the police any further about Tyler's case. He stated that he had been questioned by them at least two times a week for several weeks, and so he changed his number as a result. On December 14, 2011, two teen inmates at the St. Lucie County Jail were arrested after accusations that they had beat Tyler. The two inmates, Woodson Fluorine and Michael Garofalo, beat Tyler on December 1st, which was caught on security video. Other inmates distracted guards so the attack could occur. The two inmates were charged with felony battery by a person detained in jail. The incident stems from Tyler promising Woodson cake and cookies for his birthday, then eating them himself. The security video shows Woodson hitting Tyler three times and Michael Garofalo hitting Tyler three times, but Tyler was not defending himself. On June 25, 2012, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that sentencing minors, including Tyler, who was awaiting sentencing at the time, to life in prison with no chance of parole, violated the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. On November 29, 2012, Tyler wrote Michael Mandel a letter insinuating that he would be using an insanity defense. He stated, "If I plead insanity and go to a state hospital, I'm looking at 10 or 15 years. That's what I pray for." In April 2013, Tyler's attorneys filed paperwork in St. Lucie County Court, indicating they intended to use an insanity plea for Tyler. Their argument was that Tyler was laboring under a mental disease, infirmity, or defect, to wit, depression. They also included on the paperwork that they intended to use involuntary intoxication as a defense. The involuntary intoxication defense was also called the Mickey Finn defense. A claim of involuntary intoxication can be used in Florida to absolve a defendant of culpability of crime. According to Fort Pierce attorney Michael J. Kessler, a defendant can be completely relieved of his responsibility if he can prove that through involuntary intoxication, he was temporarily, legally, insane at the time he committed an offense. There are several ways you can be involuntarily intoxicated, such as if you become intoxicated by accident, through the fault of another person, by your own mistake, or if you have an unexpected reaction to a medication or drug that causes you to commit a crime. Tyler said he had 18 beers and 3 ecstasy tablets the day of the murders. One case of involuntary intoxication was when 16-year-old Victor Brancaccio of Fort St. Lucie killed an 81-year-old woman who complained about his loud rap music in 1993. He claimed that Zoloft made him involuntarily intoxicated, and he did not know right from wrong. However, this defense did not work, and Brancaccio was still found guilty of first-degree murder and kidnapping. In July 2013, Tyler's attorney, Chief Assistant Public Defender Mark Harley, left his position abruptly. His boss, Diamond Liddy, would not say why he left or if he quit or was fired. Harley was a death penalty certified attorney who was working several high-profile cases. The sudden departure created a delay in Tyler's trial. Sadly, Mark Harley passed away at the age of 54 during a driving incident in Key Largo, Florida on Sunday, May 11, 2014, with his wife and mother nearby. On December 18, 2013, a Rolling Stone magazine article was published which revealed many details of the murders, but also painted Port St. Lucie in a dark light. Many of the facts in the article were not quite true, according to Assistant Public Defender Mary Saldanio. The article reported that Tyler had been arrested previously on aggravated battery charges and had been convinced on burglary charges stemming from things Tyler had posted or said on his Facebook page. Saldanio said Tyler had no prior criminal history. The citizens of Port St. Lucie were upset by the depiction of their city in the article as well. In December 2013, Chief Assistant State Attorney Tom Bockendahl filed papers notifying the defense that the state planned to present evidence at the trial concerning Tyler's behavior leading up to the murders. They quote, "Tyler had poor school performance, behavioral problems, disciplinary history, theft from his parents, drug use, and drug treatment." Bockendahl stated that these behaviors were relevant to proof of motive, opportunity, and intent. At least 200 people were called as potential jurors for Tyler's trial. In late January 2014, Tyler's attorney, Diamond Liddy, filed papers requesting that Judge Makemson dismiss the first-degree murder charges against Tyler. Liddy argued that under Florida law, there is no legal punishment the court can impose against juveniles convicted of first-degree murder. Liddy argued that teen brains were not developed and attempted to show the MRI of an adolescent brain, to which Bockendahl objected. On February 19, 2014, Tyler Hadley stood before St. Lucie Circuit Judge Robert Makemson and pleaded no contest to first-degree murder. Judge Makemson asked if he was pleading no contest because he was in fact guilty or because it was in his best interest to do so. Tyler replied, "It's in my best interest to do so." Pleading no contest meant he did not admit guilt, but he did not want to contest the charges. His grandmother, Maggie DeVittorio, sobbed quietly just a few feet away as he entered his plea. Many were shocked that he changed his plea like this, but others speculated that he decided to spare his family the pain of a trial. University of Florida law professor Bob Deckel said there are tactical advantages for Tyler to change his defense from an insanity plea at the last minute. One of these tactical advantages is the sentencing hearing. The state cannot put on a complete case for a sentencing hearing like they can for a jury trial, giving Tyler the advantage. The sentencing hearing was the first time a Treasure Coast judge was required to conduct a juvenile mitigation inquiry before imposing a punishment against a murder defendant who was not an adult when they committed the murder. Florida judges ruled the inquiry is required to comply with a 2012 U.S. Supreme Court opinion that banned sending minors to prison for life without parole, except under rare circumstances. Shortly before the sentencing hearing began, Tyler openly apologized to his family for the first time. He spoke for 86 seconds saying, "I'd like to direct this to my entire family, everyone, all of you. I know it's hard to understand, and you can't begin to explain what happened. I can't apologize or make amends for the horrible acts I have done, that I have committed. Not a single day goes by that I don't think about my parents or my whole family and how they've been affected by this. I don't expect forgiveness, and I know that they will forgive me, but I realize it took away a son, a father, a mother, a sister, a brother, and two friends. And I just want everyone to know I am truly sorry for the acts I committed. I love and care deeply for all of them. That's all I have." Bockendahl called Tyler a cold-blooded killer and lobbied for a life sentence in prison. He said, "This is not a youthful act of indiscretion. This is a cold-blooded, planned murder." Tyler's aunt pleaded for mercy, asking the judge for punishment less than life in prison. Kelly Reynolds, Tyler's cousin, said that they pray he will be rehabilitated so he can be with them again. Tyler's uncle and brother both wanted him to receive life in prison. Maggie DeVittorio cried before the court as she said she visits Tyler frequently in jail because she loves him. She had donated almost $10,000 to his jail account between his arrest in 2011 and his sentencing in 2014. She also said he never felt like he had a friend and that he was never good enough. He just always felt like he was a step below everyone else. She said she knew Tyler took medication for acne, depression, a thyroid condition, and growth hormones. On her first attempt at testifying, Maggie DeVittorio was overcome with emotion and a recess had to be called. Kathleen Heidi, an expert witness called by the defense, specializes in youths who kill their parents. She testified that in July of 2011, when Tyler used a claw hammer to bludgeon his parents to death, he was suffering from a multitude of symptoms stemming from his depression. This led to intrusive thoughts about slaying his parents, then killing himself. Heidi first evaluated Tyler in December of 2011 and had 6 meetings with him in total. Tyler's attorney asked Heidi if Tyler loved his parents. Heidi replied, absolutely he did and does. Liddy asked, how could Tyler kill the people who loved him the most? Heidi replied, you can see this boy is having significant mental health problems. Heidi identified numerous factors that would have contributed to his homicidal behavior, including severe depression, the inability to care for others, and obsessive thoughts. When questioned by prosecutors, Heidi agreed Tyler had lied to mental health experts and might have done so to manipulate findings. Backendahl repeatedly questioned whether statements Tyler had made were lies, particularly concerning his drug use and hearing voices before the murders. He also repeatedly said Tyler was smart and angry and therefore could manipulate doctors. Heidi maintained Tyler was severely depressed the day of the killings. Judge Makemson asked Heidi what Tyler expected to happen after he killed his parents. Heidi replied that he didn't plan on having a future. He was intending to commit suicide after the murders. When asked for proof of suicide, she related all the friends he had told of his plans of suicide. However, Makemson said Tyler killed his parents, had a party, then planned another. What are her thoughts on that? She replied that Tyler was really disturbed. Dr. Wade Myers, Brown University psychiatrist who specializes in child and forensic psychiatry, conducted a psychiatric evaluation of Tyler. He said Tyler, at 17, had a severe mental illness caused by depression and obsessive thoughts of self-harm and murdering his parents. Tyler had a long history of using antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications. He could have had Celexa in his system, which could have worsened his homicidal thoughts. Alcohol could have made it even worse. Tyler told Myers he had once considered killing his parents with a pair of garden shears, a hatchet, and a kitchen knife. Backendahl asked Myers if Tyler lied to him or manipulated his responses. Myers said he saw no clinical proof of that. Gregory Landrum, Hobe Sound psychologist who testified last, disagreed that Tyler had a major depressive disorder. He testified for the state and said he believed the defense experts had misinterpreted the test results to reach a major depressive disorder diagnosis. On March 20, 2014, Judge Makemson sentenced Tyler Hadley to 2 life sentences without the possibility of parole for the first-degree murders of his parents, Blake and Mary Jo Hadley, on July 16, 2011. He was transferred to a receiving center in Orlando, Florida, on Friday, March 21, 2014, where he awaited his corrections assignment. In 2016, Tyler appealed his sentence under the 2012 Supreme Court ruling that sentencing a juvenile to life without the possibility of parole violates the Eighth Amendment. After another sentencing hearing in December of 2018, Tyler was once again sentenced to life. The sentence includes an automatic review after 25 years, which begins from 2011. This review will focus on whether a life sentence is still appropriate, given his conduct and behavior in prison. Tyler is currently housed in the Okeechobee Correctional Institution. His brother Ryan is married and has written a book about the horrific acts that ripped his family apart. The book is titled, 1,000 Fireflies, Living in the Aftermath of My Parents' Murders. In 2012, Ryan donated some of his inheritance to Habitat for Humanity in Port St. Lucie. The money was used to renovate a foreclosed home, and the home was dedicated to Blake and Mary Jo. Okay, fan club members, as I conclude this episode, my one question to you is, how will you sleep tonight? Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please be sure to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast player of choice. It really does help us out. You can find us on most social media platforms, Twitter at TCFCpod, Facebook.com/TCFCpodcast. You can also find us on Instagram, TCFC_podcast. And of course, our website is TrueCrimeFanClub.com. If you have an episode request, send us an email, TCFCpod@gmail.com. Music for the show and audio engineering for the show was provided by Nico at We Talk of Dreams. Check him out on Twitter at WeTalkOfDreams or WeTalkOfDreams.com. Content warning at the top of the show was provided by Tyler Allen, host of the Minds of Madness podcast. This episode was written and researched by Suzanne St. John. While you're waiting for the next episode, check out some of my pod friend shows.
Hi, I'm Michael, host of the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast, which was nominated as one of the best British true crime podcasts of 2018. It's based on my 5-star rated guided walk and features more than 300 untold, unsolved, and long-forgotten murders, all set within 1 square mile of London's West End. So if you love hearing about new cases for the first time, old cases through a fresh pair of ears, and classic cases with a twist, all researched using the original declassified police investigation files, written using first-hand accounts, and recorded using authentic sounds from the murder location itself, then Murder Mile is just for you. Download the Murder Mile True Crime Podcast on iTunes, Acast, or your favorite podcast platform every Thursday. Thank you for listening, and stay safe.